trouble is because I don't have any photos of board makers. And all of the credit goes to John. That's his first poem ever, and he won a prize. I've never won a prize. I always think it's a really bad idea if you have to talk too much about your poems before you read them. I mean, if you can't get them, there's something wrong. So I will just say a little bit about the project, however. What we did was, about 6 years ago, it took a long time because I was doing other stuff, and Brenda had to kind of keep me honest and keep me working because I'm not a very hard worker. I'm a good drinker, though. And so it took a long while, and we tried to combine my words and her images to describe the place that we come from and how we feel about it, the people in our lives. And what we were hoping was that if we could just hit it kind of pure and simple enough, that it would be something that could be universal, even though it's very specific to our place. Okay? So I will start. The first one I'm going to do is a poem called Whisperings. I really should be more organized, but I'm not. So anyway, it's called Whisperings. The painting is of sailboats at Saline Pier, and it's looking across at an abbey called Stockton Abbey, and it's where my people are buried. Okay, Whisperings. There never was any doubt that the stones would talk to me again in dreams, when I am planted as I am with a view of where great kings once walked. In the cold grey stone of castle walls, their story is kept safe. There is no rush for them. The dead learn patience in the grave, where even rotting takes its time. They know of time, but I do not, so they can stand to wait until I am made to hear their life as the whispers of old ghosts on the wind and the singing tide. The next one. You can leave it. Don't fly along the way here. The next one is actually the first one that we wrote together. And Brenda was doing an exhibition. We worked with a few different things, and Brenda was doing an exhibition on the Shannon and all the monuments along the Shannon. And she was talking about difficulties that she was having doing paintings with water, which is so fluid, and solid structures at the same time. And I wrote this poem for her, kind of based on that idea. And then I bought the painting, actually, that we were talking about. And she said, okay, you can buy it, but you can't have it, because I'm using it in an exhibition. So I said, okay, well, you can have the poem, you don't have to pay me at all. And she used it as her invite on the front of the exhibition. So this is called The Jealous Sea. She thought to paint the stones and the castles and the chimneys that stand sentry by the sea. So I called to her and I drew her down. I entered her. She accepted me. I taught her all the mysteries of my dark and hidden bed. I floated through her and led her on a path I knew she feared to thread. Then she and I knew loss and gain. We died and were reborn. I surrendered up her liquid soul, forever altered, and through water able to understand solid form. The next one, it might be a little bit important. It's twins. I've been warning the two boys down there about twins all night. But I haven't read this one in public before. And I'm going to give it a shot now. This is it's a three-part poem, and it's my mother is an only child, de facto, but she actually had twin sisters who died when they were born. That was something that had a very big effect on her mother, her father, and herself. So this is a three-part poem, Twins. Born early, through blood and pain, the midwife took her baby girls and gave them names she did not choose. Then they were gone, ripping out her heart, lighting her womb to all other life, until they took that from her too. She dreamed of them as women the night before she died at 82. He was always handy with his hands, not a man of words. What words could have forced the awful blackness in his chest to go away? Instead, he made their coffin on the kitchen table. Praying through his work, he planed the wood until it was fine enough for tiny little girls. He handed them over to the priest, to the earth, to each other.
what does any daughter understand of sisters she's never known, of what is death, of who is in that box? But she understands distance all right, and how they would not play or laugh with her, but she was not enough. When she is grown, she'll make a family of her own. Her children will know laughter and know their mother's touch. She'll leave the coldness of the grave behind.
This one I wrote a while ago for my uncle, and because it's coming up to Valentine's Day, I'm going to read it. My uncle is a priest, and I'm very fond of him. This is called Matters of the Heart. On Valentine's Day, David Hanley read one of Shakespeare's sonnets on Morning Ireland, and we exchanged cards and promises for a sweet later on. The world held its breath as Hans Blix reported on arms in Iraq, and when it was over, both sides hardened their hearts. When the news came to me, I left straight away. My loved one well understands that there are other, different, older loves that call from the cradle and can't be denied. Once there, I could see that his heart was worn from bereavements, baptisms, betrayals, burying children, parents and friends, in search at all times for his silent God. On Valentine's Day, his heart was attacked. This one is called Bedtime Story, because, you know, children are wonderful and in equal measure terrible. And they take I can't be the only one that feels like this. They take a bit of a toll on you. And this is called Bedtime Story. Only after you have said one final last goodbye to everyone do you consent to climb the stairs with me. After you have finished off your bottle, you are still awake. And so I lie, your prisoner, eyes squeezed shut, jaw clenched, making lists of all the jobs that I must do before this day's work is done. Trapped by your happy chatter, sit-ups, stories, sounds, I think that you will never rest until, when I no longer expect it soon, some almost imperceptible change in breath tells me that you have journeyed off. Perhaps returned to days before the womb, or to the glories of your days to come, or maybe gone to simple dreams of teddy bears and new toy cars. Whatever, you are gone. And I, now lonesome, am no longer anxious to begin my evening's work. One of the things I wanted to try to do was, if you were going to write about your place and do it in such a way that it could apply to everyone, I kind of wondered if you could take stories that everybody knew, kind of flip it on its head and make them apply to you in your life. So that's what I tried in the next few that I'll read for you, and you can make up your own minds as to whether it's one or not. Not as good as John's, obviously, the maker, but there you go. The first one is called Ophelia. And I've always loved Hamlet, but I've always, it must be the feminist in me, always felt that Ophelia gets a kind of a raw deal, to be totally honest with you, you know. We see her not at her best. By the time we see her, the love affair is over. And so I wanted to write about that, about, you know, maybe that she's a bit cross that we don't see her at her best. And Brenda did a really beautiful painting to go with it, which I thought that kind of the theme I was trying to work on is that we all of us lose our gloss sometimes. Life has a way of sorting us out, and sometimes a bit harshly. And Brenda did a painting for a friend of hers who had drowned. This is called Ophelia. What did the playwright care for the young girl without a mother who played too much alone? Or for the young mother, that woman that my father would see married off, listening as my brother and his friends laughed out stories of the skirts the prince had raised? And yet, my heart would pound at the briefest glimpse of him. What did the playwright understand of all I risked in trusting him? Of my delight in loving him, of my momentary peace in holding him afterwards as he slept deeply in my arms.
The playwright did not know the terror I lived every day, that he might cast my love aside and find a better lady in my place. That fear was why I hid from him when his mother laughed too long and loud at jokes her husband's brother had no right to tell. The playwright knew me only after I had gambled all I was and lost. He knew me spent, betrayed, and floundering.
I always ask the question, what would such and such a person have been like if they came from Ballylongford, which is where I come from? And I wanted to look, my sister is called Maeve, I should say this. This is not about my sister. just in case anybody tells talk tales back. You know that story, the Fonda Pula, which I always loved, you know, the cattle raid Cooley and Maeve and Alil and the competition over the two bulls and who had the better bull, and Maeve wanted to get to be one up on her husband. And I kind of thought, God, that sounds like a really dysfunctional marriage. So I wrote this poem about their marriage, and it's a two-part poem. The first part is from Alil's point of view, Maeve. When the match was made, men envied me as I danced my joy. With our two great lambs, what could stop us from glory? And by the gods, she was beautiful. I drank in the sight of her. My hands shook when first I held her. She was wild and proud as any mountain boar, and mighty as the wind. In the end, I did not mind her appetites. Such things are common in the great. But until I knew her, what did I know of cruelty? Her viciousness, a living, breathing, savage thing. She could strip the meat from my bones with her tongue and then laugh at my suffering. She made marriage a sport, and sport into war, which she cheated to win. What peace is there for any man, no matter what he owns, when his bones grow weary and his beard is grey, if he calls wife such a harridan? For the space of a heartbeat, I could have changed. My baby's milky breath could have softened me and coloured down my raging world to white. Then he came in, chest out, puffed up with his own importance and with mine. Kingmaker, he called me. He wanted me out of my bed and back on display, his warrior queen. So I stayed as I was, as he wished me to be, forsaking innocence, demanding acquiescence, eating life whole as was my right. Change followed then, as I grew with each day and each victory, slowly, harder, colder, stronger. And for a while, he rejoiced, devouring with his eyes and his hands and his tongue his greatest possession. It was, in the end, his bones that grew weary, his blood that first cooled. Of course I laughed at him. Is anything more foolish than an old man with great emotions, whining and moaning like some flea-bitten dog desperate for rest? Why should I pity him now, if my words make him flinch? Am I not all he once boasted I might be? The next one isn't pleasant either, really. I haven't read this next one either. You know Jude, the patron saint of hopeless cases, and the painting that goes with this is actually one of the strongest as well. It's lots of blacks and oranges and very strong colours. And when I was looking at the whole idea of Jude, I thought, you know, I can't think of anything worse than to fail continually and have somebody forgive you continually. It must make you feel really bad. So that's where this poem came from. Jude. That wounded look has been with me this very long time past. A more than fitting equal to all my worst offences, and it is more powerful than any screaming match. It says, no dog would take the same abuse that I have given you. It betrays your disappointment that I have thrown away my 100th second chance. It says, you know me now, that there are no illusions left to hide my flaws and faults. But like the patron saint of hopelessly lost causes, you give no other outward sign that you are slowly drowning in my constant stream of shit. You mercifully move past it all, and I will never forgive you for it. we'll tone it down a bit now. It's called Humpty Dumpty, and I wrote it for my aunt whose husband had just died, and the painting with it Brenda did for a friend of hers whose husband had just died. So it's called Humpty Dumpty. After fate had taken down my wall, I fell apart and bled into the ground. When all the king's horses and all the king's men and all their well-intentioned wives found that no amount of hot sweet tea could put me back together again, they suggested that I pull myself together. Broken people, it would seem, as well as broken eggs, are nothing more than so much mess to those who are intact. So I stuck my 50,000 bits into a crazy paving hollow shell. That made them smile and say, "We told you all along that time would heal whatever wounds you had." Well, perhaps. But let's just wait and see how long the sellotape will last. This is one of my favourites in the book. It's called "Where Are You, Rumpel Stiltskin, When You're Needed?" And Brenda has got a painting to go with it of folded laundry in a very dark room. In the corner, there's a door to outside. And again, it's in one of my honest moments. I can't be the only person in the world who gets sick of housework and work and all that kind of stuff. And I was literally in a room with a mountain of dirty clothes and that had to be sorted out. And I came across a picture of myself and my friends the day we were coming home from having done up the hall for our devs. Now that kind of dates me because they don't have their devs in the hall anymore, but in the school hall. This is called "Where Are You, Rumpelstiltskin, When You're Needed?" The 17-year-old me in that photograph has a cocky air that says, "Move over, world, make room for me. I'm going to travel your lands and conquer you with the sheer force of my personality." My 17-year-old self is dazzling, fresh and beautiful, I realise now, intoxicated by possibility. Her cheeky grin mocks the saggy, baggy, shaggy 30-something me. She could never understand my choices. The man, the kids, the house, the cars, the dogs, the cat. My wild child is buried underneath all this bloody respectability. That and a mountain of laundry. "Where are you, Rumpelstiltskin, when you're needed to weave a spell and set me free?" So I'm going to go back to kind of the ones that we wrote. There are a lot of love poems in this book, actually. Not the ones you might expect. But there are a lot of love poems. And this is a love poem that I wrote to my son. And it's called "Winter Dancing." And I love the painting Brenda did with it because it captures the colours of that really weak winter sunlight. "Winter Dancing." The little boy dances about his joys. They bubble from inside of him, and two-year-old limbs, not old enough yet to be pinned down by Earth's incessant gravity, take flight. 10-minute-old woes are cast away, forgotten, as he moves now into the flirting light of the winter sun. Trials that might lie in store not half an hour away have no power to touch this incandescent child as he takes his bottle from his mother's hand and turns to watch TV. The little boy dances out his joys. This one is kind of the flip side of that because it's short, but I suppose no matter what you might choose to do as a parent, you have to accept eventually that your child goes out into a world that's not as perfect as you might like it to be. This is called "First Hurt." "Daughter, that day in the coffee shop, I saw you shyly wave and smile at those much older boys. No answering smile returned, and quick as that I saw uncertainty begin to grow. The apple taken, tasted, knowledge born of a less than perfect world." My kids were all very delighted. I have three children. They were all very delighted. There's a poem about each of them. Whether there was or there wasn't, I had to lie and say there was, because, you know, I have to live there sometimes. And then my son, the son that poem is about, was delighted. He said, "God, it's a great book, Mommy. There's a poem about me in it, and there's a poem about rugby." And God, I didn't know what poem he was talking about. And then slowly dawned on me what poem he was talking about. And this is it. It's called "War Wounds."
He showed me the scars from his colourful past and the false teeth which he needed because a big, ugly prop knocked out his front tooth on a cold rugby pitch. So I said, that's all right then, nobody's perfect. And I showed him what gravity had done to my boobs. And he ran, as fast as his bandy little legs would allow, in the opposite direction.
Didn't work at the age of 27.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I said gravity is a lot more than that in Scorpio. After the first book, my solicitor rang me up and he said, "God, you're very brave." I didn't really know what he was talking about. I thought, "But try to say it's really crap, like, and I shouldn't have put it in a book or something." And it suddenly occurred to me that he thought every single poem in the book was about me, which kind of removes the need for imagination, really, doesn't it? But so I'm going to preface this one by saying this is not about me. Okay, and Brenda, if you get a chance to look at the painting that goes along with this, look at the tie that's hanging on the shirt. This is called Preparing for Infidelity. Careful as always, she runs the iron in sweeping strokes over an ice blue shirt, bought to reflect the colour of a deceiving eye. Some internal need demands perfection. She applies starch to cuffs and collar, making them almost as stiff as betrayal. At times, she stops and moves the shirt along the now worn board. Inhaling clean fabric, she knows that shortly it will grace clean skin. The beauty of both enhanced by a time and effort and expense long absent from the marriage bed. She knows too that the next perfume hand upon this shirt will not be hers. Her final flair is to hang a matching tie across her faithless lover's prayer, or lover's shirt, and add her fervent prayer that the lion pig might choke on it. I did feel it kind of laid down a marker for my husband, however. I'm always saying that I don't really do romantic love all that very well, but this is my best effort. This is called Anniversary Waltz. The radio left on, cats and dogs said, car ready for the NCT, for God's sake, flush the loo. Bedtime stories, insurance paid, hold my hand, empty carton in the fridge, another match to watch, compost on the flowers, you drive me nuts. My joy, my rock, friendship, laughter, tears. After all these years, I can no longer tell which steps are mine and which are yours. Is this love? Are we happy? Is there something else that I would ask of you? What more could you possibly do? I'm going to finish up in a minute. So I want to thank Paul very much and Stephen, who I met. Gives the other guy at the table the prize, but that's okay. I'll get over it eventually. And I'd like to thank you. I was listening to the poems earlier on and I'm thinking, I'm getting out of here. Because I'm really impressed with what you could do with 5 words and 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. And if you knew how slow and painful and torturous my working process is, I'm a little bit embarrassed, really, to be honest with you. 5 words, 5 minutes, 5 words, 5 years might be more my thing, to be honest with you. This one is called The Lighthouse. And I think it kind of explains what we were trying to do with this book. If I can find it. There we go. The Lighthouse. Waiting. I am always waiting for new stories to pass me by on the breeze. Watching. I am always watching for the iron lilies floating through my seas. They whisper softly to me, secret tales from a far-off shore. They pity me, my stillness, that I must stay while they can go. But I know this is my place. I could not be myself in any other. This place has made me what I am. I am sky and wind and water.